Whenever feasible, one should always try to eat the root. Would you join me at the table?
Welcome to Eat the Rootcast, a podcast about NBC's Hannibal and the works of Thomas Harris. I'm Cooper, and I have with me...
It's Miko.
And this is Ophelia.
And tonight, tonight's episode is called Trou Normand, which is literally the Norman hole, which is a part of the meal to restore your appetite. So it's sort of a palate cleanser, but it's also there to... You know, French meals are very long, so yes. It's there to remind you that you still might want to eat more. Traditionally, a drink called Calvados is used in Trou Normand, and Calvados is an apple brandy from the Normandy region in France. So we thought we'd be all fancy tonight get some Calvados, and turns out... that either we can't afford good Calvados, or it's just not a let's sit here and sip it type drink.
No, it's not. No.
So, I know we might displease Hannibal, and we would probably be on a list now.
For drinking rudely.
But basically, I've turned it into apple teenies. So we've added some apple juice, we've added some... apple vodka too. So there was a recipe. Don't look at me like that. There was a recipe for apple teenies that had Calvados in it. So that's where we're going with it. So that's what we're drinking tonight.
It had way too much of an edge.
Yeah.
Straight.
And again, I don't know. I am not classy enough to know if that's the price or the drink itself.
Or the drink itself.
So if you out there, listeners, drink Calvados, and they're like, oh my god. Let us know.
Yeah. It is funny that you should note that it's supposed to make you hungry for the next course.
Yes.
Because I've been drinking this, and I actually, you must have stepped out of the room.
No, I was here.
Oh, you were here.
I didn't want to say anything, because I wanted to leave that for the episode.
Leave that for the episode, because I was like, I'm hungry. I want to eat. And so it's doing its work.
Well, and I actually didn't know that part of it, the restoring the appetite part, until just now when I was reading about it. I'd found the Calvados thing. I'd been probably mispronouncing that, too. I feel like the more I say it, the less likely it is that I'm pronouncing it correctly.
I'd have to see how it's spelled.
But it's really interesting because this is the point in the season where you are being reminded of the other things.
Yes,
you know,
we do.
Abigail
go back
is back this
and revisit
episode,
things, yeah.
And Will is disintegrating, and so there's a lot of, by the way, remember this, let's go through the back half of the season here. And with that in mind, let's start with the least interesting part of this episode. The killer of the week, which you'll notice, listeners, a reoccurring theme, that we are not fond of the killer of the week often. This was the most pointless killer of the week, played by Lance Henriksen.
Oh, so disappointing to have so little...
I know how excited you were when his name came up in the credits.
I was like, oh, I love him. And it was a waste of his talents.
Well, all he did was sit in his armchair.
Yeah, he had this, like, you know, here I am, and I'm going to have my soliloquy, and then that's it. I'm done.
Let's talk about the tableau, because while the killer is not that interesting, the tableau certainly is. And this is the first tableau of the season that, when I was first watching it, was just like, really? How did he do that?
Yes. Yeah, it's so elaborate and out in the open that...
I mean, there could be a lot of beachfront, sure. I don't remember where it was. But there could be a lot of beach, and it's winter, so there's snow, so nobody's going to the beach.
Was it in Baltimore, or was it in Virginia?
No,
I don't remember.
Where all the other serial killers live in Hannibal Land.
Yeah. I could have sworn it was in the D.C. area, because they usually, I think they did like a little title block thing that said where they were at when they were on the beach. And I think the only reason why that sticks with me is because in Red Dragon, Will and takes his wife and stepson to Jack Crawford's, the beach house.
Yeah,
that's like his sister's beach house, and it's
a safe house for them when
exactly. So when they were on the beach and there was something about the location of it made me think of Red Dragon, but it wasn't. It was where, you know, the actual tableau was, but it made me think of that whole thing that they stayed on the beach for a while until they got too scared to be that close and they left and went to Oregon.
So the episode's directed by Guillermo Navarro, who has directed one other episode this season and was DP of the first episode. He directed Coquille. Which, as you'll remember, is the Angel episode.
Angel episode.
It's written by Steve Lightfoot, who... must have been his debut with the show, because after this, he co-writes or writes so many episodes the rest of this season and next season. I feel like he didn't quite have a handle on it yet.
No.
Because, we've got a few things here that are way on the nose. Like Will says in his opening, this is my resume, this is my body of work, this is my legacy. And that is directly mirrored, not just subtly mirrored, but directly mirrored by Lance Henriksen when they catch him.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, I mean, we're being obvious.
Yes.
We're being obvious for no real reason. Mm-hmm. The totem pole isn't metaphorical. I guess it's legacy. And so I guess that ties in with Abigail Hobbs and writing the book. It's her legacy, I guess.
But it's also the legacy of his son. He thought that his body of work and his great legacy was being the ghost that killed all these people, but he had no idea the legacy he thought he was destroying was of this other man who I guess he was somehow...
Yeah, his ex-wife or...
Woman's lover or son, when it's actually...
That's what I was going to look up, because that whole dialogue thing...
Well, I mean, it was 100% expository dialogue, and it clearly doesn't have a whole lot of value because we're sitting here debating what it was about.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure there was a love triangle between him, a girl, and this other guy, and the other guy was the first kill... For the totem pole.
Yes.
Yes.
And then the last kill for the totem pole was that guy's son, who it turns out in a shocking twist.
What a twist.
Actually Lance Henriksen's son. And not really Lance Henriksen's son, but
the characters.
Lawrence Wells' son.
The killer of the week. I don't even pay attention to their names anymore.
No. I assure you, the killers of the week, while there are very few of them next season...
Oh,
are far more interesting.
They are KOTW.
Oh, okay. KOTW. That's it. That's their designation.
Yep. That's what you are.
The body totem pole is a puzzle on the beach. So we start with the corners, which is a cute little clever bit of dialogue.
That was...
But in no way do I feel like that's dialogue that would be said in this situation.
No.
I don't feel that these two jokers...
It was far too glib for what they were
standing in front of
at.
A human totem pole.
Mm-hmm.
That was an epic, amazing, beautiful piece of art design.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's all the value it had in this episode, is an amazing piece of design, an amazing tableau. That's it, as far as
Not
I'm concerned.
Not much else to it. Well, it didn't seem to have... It's sort of... The method to its madness was not apparent.
No.
We never really found out why was it a totem. Why was the person placed on the top the way he was done? The whole thing that they didn't know where most of the bodies were from, but there were only seven. But there were seven graves there. They gave you so much with no.
Well, they didn't. They said that they were all accidental deaths.
Accidental deaths. Yeah. Oh, that's right.
Or they were and then they were dug up.
They thought they were accidental deaths, yeah.
They were pronounced an accidental death, and then they were exhumed.
They were dug up and reburied on the beach.
No.
No, because he re-dug them up on the beach.
But there were seven graves, but there were more heads than graves on the beach.
Okay.
And then when they said they were trying to account for the extra
right.
parts that were more than seven people, because they said, I can't remember how many victims, but there were more than seven victims.
Yeah. Okay.
Somewhere in the teens, I believe.
There were more body parts.
So what they did is they located the DNA and matched it back to these accidental deaths from all over.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That he was the, you know, the ghost who, you know,
watched
everybody mourn.
In another example of just direct on-the-nose shit, Will is talking to his class about it and showing the pictures of the mm-hmm. totem pole.
Mm-hmm.
And he says the method of these murders is less important to this killer than the single fact that they die.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The killer's design was to remain a ghost, which is then echoed directly. So it's like, see? This is his design. Yes, this is my design.
Mm-hmm.
Great. I mean, this was the first killer of the week. You know, I haven't been a fan of most of the killers of the week. There's vaguely interesting stuff, but ultimately, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always want to get back to Prime Story.
Yeah.
And this one was the first killer of the week I think you could lift entirely out of the episode and have it change nothing.
Nothing. That's true. It had no bearing on what
except give us more time with the far more interesting mm-hmm. stories, which is why we're going to continue blasting through the Killer of the Week story here.
Yeah, I think for me, the Killer of the Week stuff is just whether or not the tableau itself is interesting. You know, that part fascinates me. It's like, ooh, how did they kill this time?
But
beyond that, I haven't been much interested.
All they're doing is calling attention to the fact of how ridiculous it is to believe that these tableaus were created by a person.
Oh,
especially
because they're so elaborate.
I don't know how old Lance Henriksen is in real life, but Lance Henriksen in this episode looked pretty old.
He did.
Sitting
probably
there alone.
Too old to resurrect that many bodies.
Right.
By
and
himself
tie them together.
In the winter. So, I mean, I don't know if you've dug in snow in the winter, but I have.
Yeah, and the top of the totem, the guy was folded in half, like, backwards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That can't be easy to do.
No.
Even with a dead body.
So I want to know about his elaborate collection of henchmen.
Henchmen.
That he
yeah,
utilized. Where are the henchmen? And, you know, I mean, it's the most convenient find, too. Like, they discover the DNA. They go to the guy's house. His door is open.
It is open.
He had faith that you'd find me. I mean, he's gotten... It's like the show didn't even care.
Yeah, and especially in this episode. Especially in this. And like I said, if you cannot utilize Lance Henriksen, you have already wasted the entire episode on the kill. Why did you even bother doing anything?
No, it's like, you know, it's like Neil Patrick Harris in the White Castle movie. He's just Neil Patrick Harris.
He's just
there so everyone's like, oh my God, it's Neil Patrick Harris.
And then that's it.
So Lance Henriksen's there to say, yeah, we don't really care about this story, but look, it's Lance Henriksen. Remember when he was in Aliens?
And everything else, since he's been in, like, every sci-fi movie.
He is that guy.
Yeah.
And he's playing the prison would be a luxury card. You know, I'm old, I can't afford. So it's almost like really half-assed social commentary at the same time.
Exactly.
Like, prison is better. So if I want to go to prison, let's say I'm old and can't afford to live. If I want to go to prison, I walk into a convenience store and I rob it.
But he's already a serial killer, so
that gets you special treatment in prison.
Yeah.
Being a serial killer?
Yeah. As long as it's
being an old serial killer?
As long as you're not a rapist or a child molester, and I'm sorry this is not relevant to the show, but you will be treated well.
Well, it's a little relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Vaguely. We appreciate the insult.
Yeah. Yes.
But sorry. I see your point. It's like if you do something that is vaguely above a misdemeanor, you know, you're only tiptoeing into the realm of felony.
Mm-hmm.
Usually you wind up going into some mass county facility where you're crammed in there together and you're not there for very long. You're not treated very well. Where the more dangerous, high-profile criminals are usually separated from everybody else.
That's true.
And in a sort of a higher, high security prison that usually winds up being better cared for and has more money because you don't want to let the crazies out.
Well, the high security means they don't want you spending much time with your cellmates or your other fellow prisoners.
They want to
because
keep you separate.
Yeah. You've got a rap sheet of how many people you've
you
killed.
You tend to combine people into elaborate totem poles of body parts.
So while they may not necessarily always care what happens to the prisoners, they're kind of supposed to.
They are supposed to care.
They are supposed to.
The other thing is, too, you automatically have the respect of your fellow inmates.
Okay, that's
because
very true.
Your crimes will come out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, they will find out why you're there, even if you don't tell them. They will look you up in the newspaper because, of course, prisoners have access to...
Well, obviously, he wasn't doing this for that reason.
No, he did say that he's got it made when he goes to prison.
No, but do you think it was foresight? Like, when he started killing all these people, like, eventually I'll be able to retire in prison?
I don't think it was a thought from the beginning.
So it all fell apart for him, and he's just like, well, there's always prison.
There's always prison. Exactly.
Well,
I'll leave the door open for the FBI when they come.
I think he realized how old he was getting. It was the thrill of the kill in the beginning. And then realizing how old he was getting, realizing he was not going to be able to take care of himself, figured, okay, one last hurrah, let's put it all on display, get myself caught so I can retire.
Now's the time
in
to
prison.
Be sloppy so that I can...
Right.
Well,
he did it intentionally because he had gotten away with all the others. Not
that's
a
true.
Single
he was
tab.
The ghost
and
that
there was
he
no
wanted.
Series of totems. Yeah. This was the big thing.
It just happens that after killing so many people, most people are going to tiptoe around you.
Well, let's let him be the ghost he wants to be.
It's not like the guy who...
And not discuss him anymore.
Knocked over a liquor store.
It's not like the guy who...
Not
going
to
be. Anyway,
let's discuss the far more interesting aspects of tonight's episode.
You know, like...
Will losing time.
He's just losing it in general.
So he wanders out of the tableau. He's looking at it. He's... flashback, and he opens his eyes and he's in Hannibal's office. Yeah.
And he has no idea how he got there.
Yeah.
So he went from his in the footsteps of the killer flashback to Hannibal's office. And it was one of those things where it was great because at first you think it's just a regular cut.
Right.
Until you see his face.
Yeah.
And you see
and
his reaction.
Panicking.
Yeah. And he's how did I get here?
How did I get here? Yeah. Like, I don't
You know,
and
I really
I
like
there.
That because you've seen Will... be disconcerted.
Mm.
But this is blind panic. You know, he knows he's going
off the deep end.
But I think this is the moment where he recognizes, okay, something really bad is happening and I don't know what to do about it.
Because it was a long period of time of having absolutely no memory.
Yeah.
He doesn't remember leaving. He doesn't remember traveling there. He had conversations with people.
Well, yeah, that's a drive. You know, What I love from this scene is Hannibal, first of all, you know, after the friend discussion last week, Hannibal tells him right out, I'm your friend, Will. I don't care about the lives you save. I care about you.
That was so interesting to have him say that line.
Without question. That's what I care about. That's what's important to me, is you. And he uses that opportunity to again drive that wedge between Will and Jack.
Mm-hmm.
Because he brings up, is Jack pushing you?
Right.
You know, and it's hacky story writing, but did you notice as Will's walking up on the beach with Jack, he's taking his meds?
Yes.
It's like,
out of the container.
It's like, so...
Yeah.
So do you just take these whenever? Or is it scheduled, Will? Is this antipsychotic medication?
It totally looks like in this episode, he's just taking it whenever.
Yeah.
Like, whenever he... feels some psychotic episode coming on.
He goes ahead and takes it.
You know,
and it seems to be working great.
I was also trying to figure out how many he was taking. Because when he's on the beach, it looks like he puts like 4 or 5. And I'm like, is that advisable? It is a prescription drug. Rarely is there a prescription that's take okay 4 or 5 whenever you and that, feel like it.
That brings up what Jack is doing this episode, which I feel this is one of the weakest episodes for Jack as a character. Because in that scene where Will is apologizing for not feeling himself, and Jack's like, oh, not feeling yourself is what you do. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about it. But if there's something wrong, you should tell me.
Mm-hmm.
And Will's like, okay, I'm okay. And Jack's just like, sure, great. Yeah, we're all good. You know, you may be popping painkillers like nobody's business, but I don't know what you're
it's
doing.
It's working for me. Problem, so.
I'm catching killers. I'm finding totem poles on the beach, and you're looking at them. I feel like it's almost archetype based, not character based for Jack here. Jack is boss, just like Jack was principal in that episode. But I found that more interesting, you know. But this episode is Jack is selfish boss.
I want to go back to Will and Hannibal's office.
Okay.
Only because when I glazed
over there.
Yeah, and as this happens, it's like I think I'm remembering everything, and then I glance down at my notes, and I'm like, I don't want to let this one go by. And just because we were talking about how Hannibal says I'm your friend and I care about your life,
right?
You know, more than it, and it's this sort of interesting choice of words that he uses. In this, but he also shortly after sort of warns Will and saying, I don't want you to wake up and find a totem of your own making.
Yeah.
So
which is interesting.
It was sort of, sort of interesting that whole, worry, Will sort of worries that he is taking on, all these serial killers.
The aspects of them,
where this is almost a tip from Hannibal of like, he's saying a warning of I don't want this to happen, but I almost felt like deep down inside that is really what he wants.
I think without question,
yes.
I'm looking at it from future eyes, but I think, if we go by the Hannibal we've seen in the past, if we go by the Hannibal we've seen just with Abigail Hobbs, he's interested. He's a see how they run guy.
Yes, very much.
And
so.
I don't know how to metaphorically say it, but he's just I'll knock you right off the table just to see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
I like you.
Yes.
Don't get me wrong. You're my friend. But if you might be interesting, I'm going to push you into this situation and see what you do.
And see what you do.
Because, and I really think Hannibal is auditioning Will to befriend, auditioning him to see if he is actually mentally capable to be his friend.
Mm. Because once he now finds Hannibal, out the truth.
Hannibal has considered friendship.
Has considered
I've been considering friendship.
I love that.
And now that he's considered friendship, I don't think Hannibal would say you're my friend unless he believed it. Because that's a thing. And so now, if you're going to be my friend, I want to see how you handle yourself. Mm. And handling yourself means, what if I cut you off from Jack Crawford? How do you play the game then? What if I took all your meds away? How would you play the game then?
He's knocking back those meds.
Because
I think what made me laugh about that whole thing of Will, on the beach with Jack, and the way he kind of, he's got the whole container and he kind of shakes it and knocks it back into his mouth and
like
Tic Tacs,
he's eating Tic Tacs.
It seems very like movie convention.
Yes, that's what it felt like to me too.
That if really what somebody would have done is they would have taken that container and opened it and shaken it
into their hand. And then popped it in.
Yes, there are a lot of people who take meds dry.
Yeah.
When they've gotten used to it. But they usually won't disregard
the quantity.
And it really looked like you said, like
totally
how you would just put a mouthful of Tic Tacs in there. So there's that. But I just thought it was very interesting. I love it when Hannibal brings up what to us as the audience is very obvious.
Is the obvious thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Hannibal often exists outside. I mean, he's like a big enough character that he exists outside the show. He is almost omniscient narrator at times. He is aware of almost everything. You know, it's interesting when he's surprised, because it's sort of unsettling.
Very much so, even for him.
Yeah. Like the Franklin stuff, he was a little unnerved at the beginning, but he was in it.
But he came up with a new plan.
Yeah.
And he figured it out. But that was interesting to have that moment where he was sort of unsettled and caught unawares and like, wait a minute, I was not, prepared for this.
Yeah.
So I have a little Easter egg in here.
An Easter egg?
Ooh.
Which isn't going to hatch until later. But...
I've actually never had an Easter egg hatch on my
okay, all right.
Exactly.
Except to give birth to lovely, lovely chocolate.
Yes. It's like, wait a minute, get hatch. Oh my God, I've been boiling mine.
All right. So
no, that was lovely.
I have a piece of information that's going to make much more sense later on. Yeah.
Okay.
But I thought it was extremely pertinent, and I made a note of it just because of what I know in the future. So Will tells Hannibal, after he is obviously panicked, extremely concerned with losing time, that he thinks he should have a brain scan.
I guess he does.
Yes.
And Hannibal says no to him. Stop looking in the wrong places.
Yes.
And then uses that as ammunition against
Jack. Yes.
As the person who is pushing Will to this breaking point. And I really can't talk a whole lot more about it.
Let's let that Easter egg hatch in the future.
Oh, okay. We're going to let it incubate.
I do want to mention the beautiful camera work in this scene. You know, it was all spinning cameras because it was showing us the disorientation of Will. So it's moving cameras. It's that wonderful back and forth, over the shoulder shot, where one camera's moving right, the other camera's moving left. So it's such a dynamic move, and it makes sense because Guillermo Navarro is a cinematographer, so it makes sense that he would up the game, of the cinematography in the episode.
And do more with the camera work and say more. It's
just like, I'm going to be interesting.
Yes.
Thank goodness he didn't do shaky cam.
You know, we are blessedly free of shaky cam on this show.
Yes.
I liked that when Will came to look at the bodies, there were those giant pictures of the totem poles.
Yes.
And when he came in, he was visibly, like, he was taking deep breaths. Mm-hmm. He was unsettled.
Very much so.
And it's nice to see that, because we're used to him walking in, and even if he's not confident, he's confident in what he's saying. And so to be so unnerved by everything was a really a good example of how far he is. Mm. Because, as much as some of this writing is on the weaker side, I still sort of feel like the producers had this thing that they told the network, that we're going to have a killer of the week, and hey, we're going to get Lance Henriksen, and hey, we're going to do, and they stopped caring about that at a certain point. It's with the direction season 2 goes, with far, far fewer killers of the week, it's clear that they were not their favorite thing either.
Right.
So this is the first episode where it feels like they almost sidelined the story completely without being able to actually sideline it.
Well, when you're saying about network notes, and I can kind of understand why you would want to put in a killer of the week, because you're thinking about the short attention span of a viewer, of a modern viewer.
And commercial appeal.
Yes.
You show that totem pole in a commercial?
Yes.
I'm going to watch tonight's episode of Hannibal.
Exactly.
Look at that.
Everything from mushrooms.
You show Abigail and Will having a conversation.
Yeah.
Intense, awesome, dramatic stuff. Not so great commercial stuff.
But harder to lure people. Exactly. And that there's only going to be a certain type of viewer that is going to be willing to go down the path of the relationship between people and the slow build to madness,
mm-hmm.
and all of that stuff and the slow development of things as it's going on. But you know there's somebody that's sitting there going, okay, people, so there's going to be some person in the flyover states that's going to be like, this is going too damn slow.
Yeah.
And will give up on the show. Whereas it's almost like, you know, it's a... I'm going to throw you this little bit of fast food in here.
This is the stuff that feels back. Like network.
Yes.
You know, for a show that feels so much like cable,
yeah,
there are elements that feel very network.
Mm-hmm.
And this next element is still, I think, probably the most obvious network. We're going to check in with Will and Alana's love affair.
Yes, yes.
But which what's I great said last about week it
felt very
what,
network.
What's
to me.
Great about it is they, without a shadow of a doubt, put to bed the idea of them having a love affair in mm-hmm. this episode. Which is, like, great, because there wasn't even a will they, won't they. There was just, will they? No.
Pretty much. Which is nice.
And
I did not want to go through the rest of the season with the will they, won't. That drives me crazy.
There were some really nice lines in this scene, even if some of them were a little bit on the nose. I liked when Alana came in and said, it's very moody in here.
Yes.
And Will says, that's me all over. Yeah. And this was after a time jump from Will teaching to suddenly class is over.
Well, I believe he was hallucinating.
No, he was I thought he was hallucinating.
He was hallucinating. He was hallucinating that he was lecturing class, and then Alana said...
You think?
Yes.
Alana said, I don't want to interrupt you if you were rehearsing.
If you're rehearsing.
Huh.
Yeah. He hallucinated that classroom full of people.
Because I interpreted it as he had the class left, and he was still just standing there.
Nope.
And that's why she thought he was rehearsing.
Nope.
That's interesting.
It's an abrupt cut. Yeah, like you're saying, he's talking and doing the lecture. You hear Alana's voice. I don't mean to, you know, to interrupt you if you're rehearsing. And when the word rehearsing comes out, it seems to snap him into reality. And he actually looks around like...
And realizes there's no
one in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Will promises not to try to kiss her again.
Yes.
Aw, sweet. I did like the state of regret while I'm crisscrossing the state line.
Yes. That was
a good... I mean, that is way too clever for its own good, yeah. But it is clever. So you got to give it clever, but it's just like, I see what you did there.
It was a series of clever lines, and that, you know, Alana talks about how she is.
Do you think it's interesting that Alana refers to both a relationship with Hannibal as an affair and a relationship with Will as an affair? It's like, because
I was wondering that, because I thought that was interesting that she said, I'm not going to have
it. It's very old-fashioned language, you know? Because an affair...
How do two single people have an affair?
An affair was a love affair.
Mm.
But that's, again, very old-fashioned. Now an affair is cheating. That's what an affair is.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was interesting. And I like that she says it would be reckless because she thinks he's unstable. She puts it right there.
Very much so. And she's not... She doesn't feel like she has to water that down for him at all.
And Will acknowledges that he feels unstable, too.
Yes.
She asks him that, and he nods, and it's a really, like, emotional realization, because Will is very much afraid to face what he's becoming, and he has no idea what that is, but he knows that if he keeps doing this, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse.
It's probably better for Alana to handle that when that happens, not if they being outside of a relationship, because she does seem to sort of be ready for him to lose it.
Yes,
that she knows this thing is inevitable, and I'm wondering if it's the stepping away is another way of saving Will.
Mm-hmm.
That if they were in a relationship and he finally really truly steps over to the point where he can't come back.
Mm-hmm.
If they were in a relationship, would she really be able...
She couldn't be objective anymore.
To help him. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So she's just trying to remain his last objective friend, almost.
Because
I think she can see that there's a connection between him and Hannibal, because she's known Hannibal a long time, and probably has never seen him with a friend.
Right.
Other than she's seen him with colleagues. And Will
never...
is a friend.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. Let's slide back and introduce our other plot for the episode. First, I found it unique that the credits happened at 8 minutes into the episode. And we're talking about a 42-minute episode, and at 8:20, that's when the credits hit.
I have noticed the one thing about the show is it takes forever to get to the credits.
Yeah.
I always feel like I've seen half the episode.
Except for like one episode, they had like just the, I think it was the Angels episode. They just had the killer seeing something and then,
oh,
boom,
yeah, then we
credits.
Went straight to it. Whereas all the other episodes, they give you a decent portion of the show
before the credits. Yeah.
And then we go to the credits.
It's like a Bond movie where mm-hmm. we're 25
minutes
in before
in,
the opening
and then,
credits.
Exactly. Exactly.
So Abigail is in group therapy. When we join her, where she admits he told me that he killed girls, so he wouldn't have to kill me. She's reminding us of the story. I like these little ways the show gets us caught back up with their story, because it's, you don't even really need the previously on. I mean, there is a previously on.
They always do that, which is so haphazard in the images that they show. I don't know how
it's the same
up.
Cheesy. You know, it's all the bullshit Buffy used to do too with Next Week on Buffy, the group turns into a dream.
Yes,
mm-hmm. And it's with all the dead girls and Nicholas Boyle saying that he should have killed you, so he wouldn't have had
to kill us,
and
yeah.
So Abigail wouldn't kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's a silly note, but I made a note here.
Okay,
and I think you'll appreciate it, Mika.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that when Abigail woke up, her hair looked like she'd been asleep.
Yes.
Every person who's ever woken up from a dream on a network television show has had
perfect
hair and still has their makeup on.
Yeah.
Abigail woke up like she'd been sleeping for hours.
She did.
And that was
much so.
It's you know, it's not something you should have to note.
I know. Exactly. Wow, she looks like how you're supposed to look.
Yeah, she looks like, I believe it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's...
You really got that.
It was nice.
That it really brought you back out of dream state in a very shocking way.
Yeah.
Because she's all done up nicely and all together in the group therapy. And then it's boom, you are really truly like, ah! Your hair's all over the place and you're sort of unkempt. And it gave you really the feeling that she had been tossing and turning while all this was happening.
Right, having a true night terror.
Right. And how, you know, how is her brain trying to deal with what she's been through? And then it also it manipulates us. Because we keep going back and forth between the did she or didn't she thing.
Well, yeah, I want to ask you that. Yeah. At the beginning of this episode, how were you feeling on that issue? See, that for the first time, I'm not asking you to project to the future. I'm asking that, so when we were coming into this, did you feel that she was involved more so in her father's affairs? Or were you on her side or Jack's side?
I was on her side,
mm-hmm.
But there's a part of me that wanted to be like, okay, Jack's being too hard on her and is jumping to assumptions.
Yeah.
And I wanted
Jack
to,
being hard-ass.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So there was a part of me that really, truly wanted to believe that she was 100% innocent and didn't know a darn thing. But then as time has progressed, it's become less, oh, it's obvious she did it, to... I think that there's a gray area.
That she knew a little bit of something, maybe not the whole thing.
Exactly.
And that's where I was at this at the beginning of this episode and when we watched it, is that I felt that she probably was aware that her father was wrong.
Yes.
Yeah, wasn't quite sure how,
mm-hmm.
but was aware at least.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Casey Rohl continues to impress with her... panic performance. I think she gives amazing panic. You know, waking up from that dream, her deep her face looks so anguished. Mm-hmm. She has wonderful anguish,
mm-hmm.
and I was just loving her in this scene.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, Hannibal the series likes to throw Freddie Lounds at us whenever we're enjoying ourselves.
Yeah.
And Freddie's talking about how, you know, you could write a book, you'd get money, you know.
And she does call her on it, though.
She does. Oh, totally.
You know, Abigail's like, oh, and how much do you stand? Mm-hmm. You're going to get, you know. And so, that you know, she did kind of state the obvious.
Well, and that's why I really felt like Abigail was probably on to her father. You know, mm-hmm. So we're talking in 20 minutes into this episode, not 40 minutes into this episode, because Abigail is on to Freddie Lowndes.
Yes.
Abigail, I don't think, quite understands Will. Abigail knows Hannibal is off.
Oh, very much so.
And she saw that immediately. Mm-hmm. So you don't see that sort of thing unless you're used to seeing that sort of thing. But, you know, like, Will is used to seeing that sort of thing when he looks for it. You know, I think, so, Abigail saw it in her everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that might be why she can see Hannibal.
Right, because it's more, I guess she has more of a trained eye, in a way.
Yeah.
From having lived with it. Yeah, and that, I think that was probably when I was sitting there wondering where in this gray area Abigail was going to be. Because the way Freddie is really pushing it, you know, is she's playing that opposite card of Jack of, I know you didn't do anything.
Yeah. And she's playing good cop.
Right, exactly. Now's your chance to get the word out. And, you know, and if you tell everybody what really happened.
She's playing exploitative.
Completely. And I love how it's this whole idea, if you write a book, then you're absolved because you've told the truth and everybody knows.
Yeah, tell the world how your side of the story. Truth.
Your truth. Exactly. It's like there's a lot of versions of people's truth out there in books.
Yeah.
And but it doesn't make it guaranteed.
OJ even wrote a book, If I Did It.
Exactly. Oh. But it doesn't. It does not guarantee that it is not still fiction. It is merely only.
No, I think that one's actually true.
The reality. Well, there's a lot of stuff. For that. I don't even.
We will not digress. Yeah. To I know. An OJ.
You didn't want me to digress. Don't let me get started on OJ. Having been in LA at that time.
Indeed. Well, let's instead talk about Will and Hannibal as surrogate fathers, because Abigail calls them on that in this episode.
There's a lot of that. They even kind of, between the two, that whole thing of we have to take care of her. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more of that ownership
and
in a parental sense.
Abigail says, just because you killed my dad doesn't mean you get to be him. It's a tremendous burn. Mm-hmm. But it's also interesting in that primal, you know, like the idea of the, if you kill someone in battle, you take on their power, you know, and the idea, if you kill a king, you can become the king. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like there's a lot more depth to it than just the idea of dad. It's the idea of ascension to the throne of dad and ascension to the throne of this killer who, I don't know if we've really discussed this, was getting along just fine until the FBI accidentally stumbled upon him.
Yes.
I mean, that's an interesting thing.
Yeah,
he killed a lot of people.
Yeah, but they weren't exactly looking for him.
They wouldn't have found him except for accidental stuff.
I think another thing with the whole father taking over the fathership thing, it also might be how when you killed another knight in battle, often you would then take care of that family. Mm. You know, how they would wed the wife.
Oh, yeah, right.
And I'm wondering if maybe that is sort of...
Will feels a chivalrous obligation.
Exactly. Now, because I have done this, it is the honorable thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Would be to then take care of her. And I think it's also it's a story that comes up in literature a lot, of an accidental death or some kind of thing will happen where the character takes on almost like a guilt of then they wind up then taking care of a child in the process.
I wonder if Will sees a lot of the brokenness that's in him in Abigail.
Probably,
you know,
very
Hannibal
much so.
Hannibal sees a budding killer and someone who can be molded. Will sees someone who's been traumatized and is akin to him. Jack sees someone who's bad.
Yeah, you know, Jack's version of it, of her being like a cold-blooded killer, like her father, seems so extreme.
It's very black and white.
Very much so.
You know, that's it.
Whereas, I do think it's a gray area. It could be she was involved, but against her will.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, when you are a child and presented with one form of reality,
You know, even if you start to recognize the wrongness of it, you're being molded by your parents often. Hannibal really leans on Abigail in this episode, just hitting her with all this stuff that's clearly 100% meant to protect himself.
Mm.
And then we see the mysterious person digging in the snow and finding the mysterious face in the snow.
Hannibal did kind of threaten her.
He did.
You know, so I was not surprised.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, oh, you know, this was like, okay. Yeah,
You
want to play this game? We're going to play this game. Exactly.
I'm a better player than
Let's see what happens when I take my, you know, the security I was offering you away. Because, you know, because you won't play the game the way I want you to play the game.
Okay, let's talk about this, though. Later in the episode, it sounds like Abigail dug him up.
Really?
Because Hannibal gets upset that Nicholas Boyle's body resurfaced.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's affecting his livelihood.
Yeah.
Abigail, there's a lot of talk about her. I mean, did she go and dig him up? Because it's very ambiguous who is digging him up. We don't see it. They're wearing the big parka.
You don't see it.
And, I mean, I could be wrong, and listeners, please let us know if you feel you got a handle on this. But I think it was Abigail who dug him up, which means Hannibal took Abigail to where he buried him, which is weird.
Yeah.
I thought he would have just taken care of it.
Yeah.
But maybe he wanted that whole, we're in it together, we're in it together, we're in it together. But, so yeah, I think we're all a little confused.
The way I interpreted his dialogue in that thing was it was a... you and I both know I did it. But if I say I didn't do it, there's no way that you're going to prove.
No, actually, later,
yeah.
When Hannibal visits Abigail, he says, you uncovered Nicholas Boyle, you brought Nicholas Boyle back.
Uh-huh.
And it says, you betrayed my trust to her.
Ah.
So, it's weird that... she did that.
Yeah, that seems weird. What would make sense to me more is that Hannibal's upset that, you know, she betrayed his, you know, his trust. And there's this, you know, thing going on between them. So his sort of like, you know, so there kind of moment would be, to uncover it and then pretend like he didn't do it repeatedly.
Yeah.
To the point where she's like, okay, well, now I can't point the finger at him because I thought it was all done on purpose that way to kind of take the power away from her in the situation and basically go see what I can do to you.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the way I interpreted all of that. That he was going to continue to then say, why did you do this until she starts thinking she did.
Well, I think Nicholas Boyle is almost a MacGuffin. His body is not even a really... It's a function of the plot.
Mm.
And after this episode, we don't have to deal with him anymore. Because it's out.
Okay.
You know, that part's out. So now it's more about relationships, which is what I like. You know, seeing those relationships. I found it very interesting that when Jack has his little come to the principal's office meeting with Will, Alana, and Hannibal... he came and grabbed Will out of the other storyline. Will's hanging out in the lab looking at the totem pole stuff.
Yeah.
Jack comes in and says, I need you in here.
Yeah.
So it's like the show's just like, hey, everybody, stop paying attention to this.
And then
we've got to deal with this other story, the more important story, the better story.
Right.
So Nicholas Boyle was found gutted. Jack wants Abigail to identify. This is a scene we've already seen.
Yeah.
This is the, should Abigail go back to the house?
Right.
You know, it's...
Yeah, they're all adamant that she didn't do the book, but they don't have a problem with showing her a dead body.
Well, it's, I mean, You know, Jack has the look of a man with no interest in anyone's opinion but his own, as Hannibal says. Mm. Let's move on to the morgue where Alana and Abigail are going to see Nicholas Blair.
Yes.
And
it's I loved the
long shot there.
Uh-huh. The things that were said without words.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes.
There's a lot of tense emotion
a
there.
A lot.
I mean, the daggers that were being shot, mm-hmm. And like you said, the panic. Not only does she do panic very well, she also does the innocent.
The wounded girl. The wounded little girl.
She's so good at that.
Yeah, and Jack really confronts her there.
Well, Jack uncovers him aggressively.
Aggressively. Like, well, yeah, it's he just has every bit no... of it is just, yeah.
He feels like it's all an act.
Mm-hmm. And Abigail wants him covered back up, and Jack refuses. And for the first time, we see Jack and Jack's respect for Alana strain when he says she is here by invitation and can leave.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they do a lot of tense sort of arguing, and because she's like, this is wrong.
Right.
And she's frustrated because she knows it's wrong, but feels powerless to really do anything about it. And is aghast that Jack is not level-headed enough.
Well, he's just relentlessly barreling. He's bull in a china shop here. Mm-hmm. He's not messing around. He's not...
jacking up the law.
He is jacking up the law, absolutely.
And sorry, I had to.
Well, I like the moment where Jack asks Alana why she believes Abigail, and she says that any reservations I have about Abigail don't extend to Hannibal because he has no reason to lie about this.
Yes.
Yep.
And it's the kind of thing. So we immediately go to Hannibal visiting Abigail. So it's another one of those. My favorite thing about this show is how we're talking about someone and we cut to them doing the thing that, ironically, they're doing.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
There's no reason to lie. Oh, here's Hannibal going to talk about why he's lying.
Why he's lying? Yeah. Yes.
And it's almost cliche, but it's done so well that I'm on board. I'm there. So Will is with Nicholas Boyle's body then, and he does the pendulum thing.
Yes, yes.
And I thought this was a really interesting version of the pendulum, because first Will stabs Nicholas Boyle, who turns into Abigail.
Abigail, yeah.
Who then stabs Will.
Him. Yes.
And, I mean, I may be really just overselling Casey Roll's performance, but she did the exact same horror when she stabbed Will is when she stabbed Nicholas Boyle. Like, the beat per beat, moment per moment was exactly the same. And I think that's a really nice touch.
Yes, she is very good at the full span of emotion.
So we're in Hannibal's office and Will bursts in again. Like him, I kissed Alana Bloom last time. It's like he bursts in. He does. He's a dramatic guy.
He bursts in
with Abigail Hobbs killed Nicholas Boyle.
Yeah.
And Hannibal just calmly, yes, I know.
Yeah, I know.
I helped her dispose of the body.
Yes.
What do you want from me? And he hasn't told Jack Crawford because he was hoping it wasn't true. Oh, Will hasn't told Jack Crawford because he was hoping it wasn't true.
Mm.
There's a moment where Hannibal fingers his scalpel.
Yes.
Before explaining that he did it for Abigail's best interest. And it's just like, there was another moment in the show earlier this season. It's when Jack first visits Hannibal. Mm-hmm. And he's looking through the pictures and talking about the fine lines. And Hannibal picks up his scalpel and then puts it down and arranges it again. I think that's the pilot. But it's another one of those really menacing moments where you see that despite their friendship, Hannibal is a predator, and he will act defensively immediately.
Don't touch his stuff.
Don't touch his stuff. in, we're going back to the parenting thing. You know, we are her fathers now. We have to serve mm-hmm. her better than Garrett Jacob Hobbs. I'm thinking maybe a Paul Reiser sitcom, perhaps.
My Two Dads.
But I liked Hannibal's Do I Need to Call My Lawyer?
Mm.
Because it's very underplayed. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the wounded appeal for friendship.
Yes.
That's Hannibal being manipulative. Mm-hmm. It's not panicked. It's not threatening. It's, tell me, do I need to call my lawyer?
Right.
And Will's like, no, it's cool. Whatever.
Yeah. And it's great that Hannibal is able to present what happens, the truth of what happens, with enough of a slant to make it look like, well, I was just helping.
Yeah. I didn't want to take her through that, mm-hmm. you know? She's already got hard enough time. Yeah. I don't want to put her through that. And Hannibal even puts his hand on Will's shoulder and mm-hmm. gives him that hard, yeah. hard sell there with mm-hmm. what we're doing is the right thing.
The right thing.
The right thing. We do get a dinner sequence this episode.
Yes, we do.
Unfortunately, Freddie Lowndes is there.
And I love that that she's vegetarian.
She's a vegetarian.
Yeah.
She's sniping about, why would you want to ruin this great salad with all that meat?
With all that meat.
She's obnoxious.
Oh, I know. Every time she's on, I can't.
Hannibal to run over and just take a big bite out of her yes, face.
Exactly. You know,
Max Cady style. You know, bite right out of her cheek.
Exactly.
So there was so much obnoxiousness at the dinner. I'd like to mm-hmm. cut to what happens in the kitchen afterwards.
The only interesting thing in the dinner is Will and Freddie bickering about insanity.
Exactly. You know,
it's just this little sniping back and forth about, insanity. Oh, who's crazy? Yeah. Oh, maybe you're crazy.
Well, it's no different than we're all psychopaths.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. It's all about gray area.
We are retreating a lot of the same ground in this mm-hmm. episode. And I think it really is the show gearing up to take us into the final act mm-hmm. of the season. And, I mean, we're there pretty much. So it's gearing up to show us the really dark stuff. Mm. But yeah, so Hannibal and Abigail are washing dishes, which I love when mm-hmm. Hannibal's domestic. Yes. You know, it's one of those interesting things. Mm. And how Hannibal's assuring her that Will will keep the secret.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, the only good thing in his life is tainted.
Right.
If he doesn't, you know?
Yeah.
Yep.
But then there's the reveal.
So how did you take this? Because this is the first big surprise of the season, I think.
But I think this is why I mentioned that along this time, I've always considered it a gray area.
Mm-hmm.
Because what she admits to is not Jack's reality.
That's very true.
She doesn't just like turn and go, yeah, that's right. I did that and I enjoyed it and the two mm-hmm. of us did it together.
I told Dad kill that one.
Yeah, right. And then that went and I don't like her. And she looked at me funny in class. I wear that shirt better than her. Go kill her. You know, that's the Jack way of her persona.
He's got her as a bad guy.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas she presented it sort of in a way that I thought if she was an active participant, she was not either a willing participant or she was in a reality that she could not do anything but participate.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Exactly. And when we see it, I think we really get that impression. Like, she is not there because, I mean, she's a sociopath because when she sits down next to that girl, she's all confident and friendly.
Right.
That is sociopath without question. But she definitely does not want to be doing it.
And you also have to think if she talks about it in the group therapy that
the dream group.
The dream group, exactly. Oh, it's very Nightmare.
Nightmare 3?
Yeah, exactly. When they were all in there.
Dream Warriors.
Exactly. Where.
Don't want to dream no more. Ophelia is not impressed by my docking.
I know. Come on. It's Freddy movie and Dawkins.
I'm supposed to be restraining from tangents.
Yeah, totally.
I'm being a little self-righteous here.
You are.
Exactly.
A little.
Okay. Anyway.
Anyway, she, in the group, the dream group therapy session, one of the things she talks about is that, that whole concept of these girls had to die so I
could survive.
Could survive. Or so I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very easy to imagine in that situation where, what do you do? I die or these girls die. So is that also,
or you call the police,
part of...
I mean, because there's always that option.
I know,
you
but...
say, hey, my dad's a serial killer. He's the guy who's been killing all these girls. You should come and get him.
I know.
I'll be out.
But it might, you know, but there's like abused kids that could do that.
And it is battered wife syndrome. Mm-hmm. It is, oh my goodness, Patty Hearst
mm-hmm.
syndrome. What you have here is the dynamic that, okay, this is, number one, it's my father, so there's probably some weird loyalty feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, you have the, well, if he can do this, if he has the capacity and the drive to want to do these horrible things to these girls, and he would really like to be doing those horrible things to me, what if the police don't believe me?
Yes.
Okay.
What if he finds out before I can say something? Mm-hmm. What if there's all these...
It could easily turn on her.
Yes.
Very quickly.
Or at least she's convinced that it can.
Exactly.
And I'd also like to go back to the comment you made about her being a sociopath. I feel like there's an interesting correlation with Hannibal and Abigail here, where he, before we even go to the black and white train sequence,
mm-hmm.
before we actually see evidence,
yeah.
we just hear her breaking down
mm-hmm.
in the kitchen. Hannibal says, you are definitely
not a
victim.
You're not a monster.
You are not a monster.
You are a
victim. Because he has seen monsters.
Mm-hmm.
She's definitely
a
victim.
And she's definitely a victim.
And in a previous episode, he calls her a survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to pull up just a little bit of Hannibal's background. What you, Cooper, do not like to acknowledge.
Ooh.
What
called me out.
Yeah.
Created Hannibal.
What created Hannibal
was an element of survival. He had to survive.
Yeah, I know.
To not become somebody else's meal. And so he is now bringing this out of Abigail, saying, no, you're not a monster. You had to do this. You had to do this so that it wasn't you. It was them or you. And it's the most basic of human instincts is...
See, I would rather look at Hannibal as a survivor in the present. Hannibal is someone who has crawled his way to the top of the class and sees himself as the apex predator.
Mm-hmm.
The apex predator is always being challenged, and that brings up survival instincts.
Mm-hmm.
So I could see, totally, Hannibal acknowledging himself as a survivor in the present without having to go into all those tawdry, cheap details from his past.
Well, Hannibal doesn't go into those tawdry, cheap details. Thomas Harris does.
I know.
So
I
why don't you write him a letter?
I don't need to. I think the world collectively said, Hannibal Rising? Shitty. Shitty, Thomas Harris. Stop that. Well, and that's why we haven't had another Hannibal book since.
This was in Hannibal. I have not read Hannibal Rising. Mm-hmm. I am bringing up information from Hannibal. So...
We will agree to disagree on the validity of the past of Hannibal. But we're going to find out next season, because I've been told that a lot of those elements are coming into play next season.
Oh, next season. So we'll revisit this.
We will be able to see what Brian Fuller's version of Hannibal's past is going to be.
Yeah.
And he has already said it will be dramatically different than Thomas Harris's version of Hannibal's past.
I'm sorry. My phone's not on vibrate.
It's okay.
I got an email.
There's one other thing that I wanted
to... No, I like to think that ding was supporting my idea. Ding.
Ding. Yeah.
Go on.
Oh my goodness. Really? Okay. So One of the other things I wanted to talk about,
more alcohol,
before we go to the train scene is there's a moment where I recalled the scene with Alana and Abigail in the hospital. And
the first scene with them?
Right, when she first goes in to talk to her, where it's obvious that she's withholding information and she's manipulating the conversation. And then Alana, of course, reports this to Jack.
Mm.
Again, coloring Jack's perception of Abigail,
mm-hmm.
which goes way down the rabbit hole. But there's a second where I remembered that and thought, could Abigail be lying about helping her father just because she feels like that's what Hannibal wants to hear? Because she knows Hannibal is
that
off.
I had that thought as well.
Yeah.
During until that, is this a ruse? Is this something I just...
Like, I don't know if I believe her admitting to it now after all this.
Right.
When she has killed someone and Hannibal has helped her bury the body. And yet she's still keeping that a secret from him?
And that this moment to reveal
or did
it.
She
or is it just,
see that need that Hannibal has for her to be that
if I say person. This, then I will get all this attention.
Because it's she's trying to preserve herself.
Mm-hmm.
And she knows that Hannibal is a formidable opponent.
Yes.
So
very
to speak.
Much so.
So if she's playing on this whole father figure thing, she's going to want his sympathies for her. She's going to want his guidance and his overseeing of her because that protects her.
Mm-hmm.
So the more that she is the thing that Hannibal wants to protect and cultivate, the more she would be likely to maybe spin a web.
Yeah.
But then, of course, we cut to the black and white. And I remember feeling this way when I first saw it, and it just brought it right back up when we rewatched it, that I was really convinced that maybe she was just making it up.
Mm.
And then
I did have the same thought.
And then the train sequence happened, and I'm like, okay, well, apparently that's not the direction they're going with this. She actually did help.
And I think because she kind of, like, she's in the kitchen, she kind of gets that faraway look in her eye. When she, you know...
The flashback look.
Yeah,
The flashback look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When she does that. So there is a moment where you're like, well, you know, just because she says it here...
Right. She could be manipulating the situation.
Right. Could it be in this... Yeah. I need to turn everything back towards me.
Mm-hmm.
I've had distraction with other stuff, with Alana and with Will and with everything, with Freddie Lowndes. It's like, is it her... trying to take the power back in the situation.
Yes,
Sort of manipulating people with the, well, did I or didn't I?
Right, yeah. Because that does seem to be like it was a theme up until this point.
Mm-hmm.
They do kind of bounce on both sides of that fence. Yeah. But, then we get the train scene, and as you had mentioned, she does the psychopathic... turns on the charm.
Yeah.
I also don't feel that's necessarily a psychopathic tendency.
Sociopath. There's a difference between a psychopath and a sociopath.
I was just unsure which word you used.
Mm.
Sociopath. So I feel like that itself goes back to the Patty Hearst syndrome and the being battered wife syndrome. You can turn that on when you're trying... I mean, she does. She had that moment where she looks at her father, and you see this trepidation.
Mm.
She doesn't really want to do this. Mm-hmm. But she looks at her father and she sees that crazy, and it's basically, it's her or you.
Yes,
and that's again those words that are spoken in these actors' faces without. Actually saying anything.
If
I got the creepy, do it now.
Yeah,
or I'll be serving you up.
Exactly.
Like it's
you
your
really
choice.
Get that, and it was sort of like a smug.
You pick. Yeah, it
kind
was.
Of, yeah,
smug. Like like we've had this conversation before.
Right.
Don't challenge.
You
me,
know where this is going to go,
or you're
so
gonna
I don't
die.
Have to. Yeah.
Yeah, basically. And then you see her switch the light switch on, and she goes from that fear and trepidation right into sweet talking.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't necessarily...
Okay.
Because one of the things is, I mean, there's the sense of justice and right and wrong in the definition in the DSM-4 for a sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, you know, the complete disregard of right and wrong, even though knowing what's right and wrong.
I suppose it would come down to if she's manipulating everybody.
Mm.
Okay, yeah.
Which is
because I feel that, you know, while I'm completely into Casey Rawls' performance when she has her panic moments, I do wonder if her panic moments are a form of manipulation, a performance that Abigail Hobbs is putting on for those who need to see it.
Mm. Yes.
Good point.
And I think that goes just back to the lead up from the previous episodes of her ability to manipulate and withhold information
absolutely
to get what she wants.
And I mean, if not full sociopath, surely she's got tendencies. She's got
absolutely.
She's got all these tendencies.
She's on that road.
She's got that. She's got the precursor. She's got the well, of course, we can go into the discussions of natures versus nurture and what makes the sociopath. But
Dad probably helped.
Just a bit
when,
there.
When the mommy beat
and Hannibal made breakfast for dinner, which is madness.
Yes. But she can definitely have those tendencies without being full on sociopath. Mm. But I don't know, maybe that's going to get fleshed out later on in other episodes. But for right now, from what we've seen, I feel like it's more she was doing it as a survival mechanism. And it goes to those questions, those ethical questions that you have, like, would you push one person in front of a bus to save 500?
Yeah.
Would you really let all these people die just to preserve yourself?
Yeah.
And
what's
interesting, too, is that she's mentioned before in the past that she, when she breaks down, it actually in front of Will and Hannibal and says, I just wish he had killed me. No, she didn't. If she really had wished he had just killed her, this whole scene in the train,
would never have happened.
She would have given up.
But don't you think that's just basic self-preservation? You know, there's one thing about wishing it was you instead of these other people.
And then
there's another to say, no, I'm not going to do this. You'll just have to kill me.
Yeah.
That actually takes far more strength and security to say that, to make that choice. I mean, the ethical question is this person or these people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not you or these people, because most people will self-preserve over other people because we are all very self-centered, because our brain is saying, no, don't make that decision that would kill me.
Exactly. That's how it's supposed to work, to keep us out of trouble.
There is a TED Talk where we can refer to the innate self-preservation of human beings. And it's actually one of the most long philosophical questions is a human basically good or bad? So they have all these examples of, I mean, we don't have to list the examples of humans being horrible, but there was a gentleman in New York City. One of the examples that they used of people being inherently good and not being self-preserving, who had his two sons with him, and he saw a woman, or no, it was a man, jump in front of a train and was going to, I believe, commit suicide.
Yeah.
He, calm as all get out, asks two strangers to hold his son's hands.
Yeah.
He jumps down on the tracks, pushes the man down, holds him in between the tracks, and the train passes over the both of them.
Yeah, I remember that.
With about an inch, if he had flinched, they both would have died. But completely calm, made the decision that this other man's life was worth saving.
Right.
Also, I mean, the decision to put his children's lives into the hands of strangers.
Of strangers, yes, that's big too.
I mean, there's a lot here where he is not thinking about just himself and his things. He's thinking about that person that, he needs to save. And so this really is one of those unanswerable questions.
I don't think we're going to be able to solve tonight whether or not humans are innately good or bad or selfish or not.
It's a very difficult discussion.
It's not black and white.
I don't know. It's definitely
it is not black and white. So I just wanted to throw that out there to give you food for thought that it's not just black and white.
Yeah.
not just black and white.
Yeah, I think it would very much put us on that path at the last 10.
So
it really didn't answer a whole lot. Instead, it just presented all new questions.
Yeah, yeah. So was she really, truly, regretting the decision to not surrender to her father? Right. Or another idea is maybe she thought that even if she did stop helping him, he'd just go on killing with her.
Right, that's very true. It wouldn't even have mattered.
And it wouldn't matter at all.
Yeah, is it likely if she died, he'd stop?
Right.
Right.
If he had that drive and that need and whatever to be satisfied, even if she did say, I'm not going to help you anymore, and he kills her, would all those girls still have died?
Right.
Who knows? Maybe. Maybe she was convinced that it would make absolutely no difference whether or not she helped or not. It just, the only difference was, do I live or do I die?
Well, next week we have the scariest opening of any episode of Hannibal.
Oh, yay! I love scary openings.
Freaked my shit out.
Really? Oh, I can't wait now.
And the next few episodes all have very interesting kills in them. So, we've got that coming up. So you should be excited.
Yes, I'm very excited.
If you want to contact us, you can do that by emailing us at eattherudecast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at eattherudecast. Thank you to everyone who's been posting on Reddit. Please continue to spread the word on
Redditors
Hannibal
Unite.
TV Reddit. And if you are a Tumblr person, tell the Tumblrverse about us because I'm confused by it. Maybe you can tell me how to use it.
I keep trying to explain to Coop what Tumblr is, but I don't know whether I'm not very good at explaining. Or
well, it did take me forever to understand Reddit.
Ah, so we have to get maybe once we put together, I would love to do an Eat the Roadcast Tumblr.
Well, we should do that.
Yeah, only because I think I need more time-wasting things in my life, but I think it would give me...
I was just saying to Ophelia, Miko doesn't have enough to do.
No.
She should have a hobby.
She should have a hobby. She needs one more hobby.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Maybe Tumblr for Eat the Roadcast.
I think she's got too much free time in the day. We need to fill that, That 4 hours she's been sleeping a night, we gotta knock that off.
Join us again next week as we come into the home stretch on this, the first season of Hannibal, for the last few episodes. We've still got 4 episodes left, so we're not really, home stretch. But we're getting there, which means
more than halfway.
Season 2 is coming soon.
Yay.
So, thank you for joining us at the table.